The Spirit of God, like a fire, is burning. Latter-day glory begins to come forth.
Vision. Project Zion Podcast explores the unique spiritual and theological gifts that the Restoration offers for today's world. We aim to feature a wide variety of guests and panelists with roots in the Restoration tradition from Community of Christ and our friends in the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. The music has been provided by Mark Abernathy. You can find his music at www.mark-abernathy.com. Glory to them in highest, be here henceforth and forever.
Amen and amen. Hello, I'm Seth Bryant, and this is Project Zion. This episode is being recorded from Nauvoo, Illinois, and I'm very excited to have Dr. Ugo Perrego with us. He's a molecular biologist who's been studying the DNA of Joseph Smith Jr. since 1999. Our topic is research that he has undertaken to see if there is a paternal connection between Joseph Smith Jr. and Josephine Lyon. Welcome to our podcast.
It's good to be here.
Thank you. Yeah, so excited. So can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, just a normal guy, which have been given some opportunities to work and develop in the area of my interest. And so I have two passions in life, two hobby or two major interests, which is very interested in Mormon history and culture and scriptures. And as well as I'm very passionate about science, in particular the information we can learn from DNA. By training in science, I have a PhD in human genetics and biomolecular sciences from a university in Italy. I study with Dr. Torroni, who was the first individual to identify diversity in DNA among Native Americans, and he's been a great mentor, a great experience to study under his mentorship. I have written and keep researching in the area of population migrations, and not just the Native American population, but also other type, other people, other continents, and geographic areas. And not only in humans, but also in animals, domesticated animals particularly. That has been kind of like my major area of studies. I do also special projects and consultation in the area of genetics, both at the individual level or for groups or companies, both in the forensic area, paternity legal testing. Pretty much anything has to do with DNA. DNA testing is the principles, the techniques are pretty much the same. It's just the application that that changes, you know, how you use it for it. And I am currently living in Italy, in Rome. I am the director of the Institute of Religion for the LDS Church there. Had this opportunity to take this job three and a half years ago, and it's been a good experience for myself and for my family. I'm also continue to work in the science as a visiting scientist for the University of Perugia, and continue with my consultations and side projects as I go.
We ran into each other here in Nauvoo during a presentation that you gave on on DNA overall and on Josephine Lyon, as well as other potential progeny of Joseph Smith Jr. I think a lot of our listeners may know the story or the background, but for those who don't, she was born 8 February here in Nauvoo, Illinois in 1844 to Sylvia Session as well as Windsor Lyon, or at least that's what we think at this point. And we have this really fascinating quote, and I'm reading from The Persistence of Polygamy, Volume 1, subtitled Joseph Smith and the Origins of Mormon Polygamy, edited by Newell Bringhurst and Craig Foster. It's published by John Whitmer Books. We have this great quote that's in here, and it's in your article, Ugo. This is the words of Josephine herself. She says, "Just prior to my mother's death in 1882, she called me to her bedside and told me that her days on earth were about numbered, and before she passed away from mortality, she desired to tell me something which she had kept as an entire secret from me and all others, but which she now desired to communicate to me. She then told me that I was the daughter of the prophet Joseph Smith, she having been sealed to the prophet at the time that her husband, Mr. Lyon, was out of fellowship with the church." So that's a quote that's been examined by a lot of different people over the years, and we're finally at a place where it's possible to do some genetic testing to see if that is indeed an actual reality, or if there's a mistake that's been made somewhere along the way in terms of her paternity. So is there anything else about Josephine that you wanted to add about her story or her life?
Well, I'm not a church historian, you know,
sure.
And I'm very careful about not representing myself in areas that are not my own. Many of the cases that I have been working on, including Josephine, is because somebody thought that perhaps science could provide an additional layer of information. And since I deal with that, usually I'm the one that get approached, especially if it's something that has to do with church history or I've done stuff on the Mount Ameno massacre, Joseph Smith progeny, ancestry, and other things that are somewhat related to Mormonism. And with regard to Josephine, all I can say is this. This actually go back to my previous work with other cases. The very first case that I was asked by descendants of Moroni Pratt, who was a son of Parley P. Pratt, I was asked to see if he was indeed Parley's son, because there was records that he was actually Joseph Smith's son. And what that requires is, in addition to the DNA testing, I like to ask the person, well, okay, I never heard of that. Where did you hear about it? Okay.
Sure.
And then they give me some references, and I go and look up these references and I see how solid they are and if there is really an hypothesis that is worth investing time and resources to test. In the case of Josephine, as it was with Moroni Pratt, these things have been recorded in books, in history books. And once something is written, usually it becomes a pretty, no matter if it's incorrect, but it kind of become a source and people will refer to it often. And as I was looking at some information, I came across to a record, a family history record, where Parley was talking about his posterity. And Joseph Smith was already dead. He's already been killed. But his Parley's second wife, Mary Ann Frost, was sealed to the prophet, was sealed to Joseph Smith. So Parley was married civilly to this woman, but not for eternity, as we do, in the Mormon Church. And he said, in his statement, he said that all of his children would be Joseph. And now we need to understand maybe, or trying to understand what they meant with, how strong
right.
was to them such a statement. For us, is especially for myself, one thing is a biological relationship, another thing is an adoption, is a sealing, and so on. To me, science, biology, heredity, it only goes in one way, it works only one way. But in the church, there are different meaning that are still very strong for some people. So when I read the affidavit that Josephine left, the one that you just read, and his mother, her mother saying to her, "You are Joseph Smith's daughter," the first things that came to my mind was this Parley reference where it says that all his children will be Joseph. And I'm sure he taught that principle to his children. if that's what he felt was true, and it was real, and what he meant was that they were his, he'd probably say, you know, look, I'm raising you, but you are really his. And I'm wondering if that could be an interpretation that can be given to the affidavit.
Sure.
So I have no problem whatsoever if Josephine is either Windsor's daughter or Joseph Smith. It seems to me that this affidavit bring and other circumstantial evidence that have been brought forth by individuals like Brian Harris and Don Bradley and others, that seems like this is the strongest case where offspring could have been born through polygamous union from Joseph Smith, but still leave a little bit of room for interpretation, you know. And that's probably why after more than 150 years, we're still wondering what is the significance of this statement. Is there a way to validate it or to nail it, you know, and give its true meaning?
Right. And in the case of Moroni Pratt, there was a much better case scenario in determining whether it was Parley or Joseph.
Yes.
Versus Josephine. Can you
absolutely?
Can you tell us a little bit about the challenges that we face specifically with Josephine compared to testing that we might do with Y chromosome as well as the mitochondrial DNA?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. There are basically three methods to apply DNA to family history or paternity, this kind of relationships. And one is the Y chromosome, which is one of the sex chromosomes. And that chromosome is found only in males and is passed almost unchanged from father to son. In many Western cultures, it would follow the surname line. So it's fairly easy to test because after several generations, you can still expect to find a pretty accurate profile and signature. So in the case of Moroni Pratt, since you mentioned it, and if Moroni was conceived during a time when Joseph was still alive, so you know, we're talking only about spiritual unions, or we're talking about full, complete unions. So we have three individuals. We have Joseph Smith, we have Parley P. Pratt, and then we have the woman who is Marianne Frost. If Moroni is Parley's son, he would have his father Y chromosome. The two would have a nearly identical, if not identical, signature on the Y chromosome. If Moroni is Joseph's son, he would have Joseph Y chromosome. And it's very straightforward. I'm not saying easy because, you know, sure, you always have to find the right people to test and the resources to do that. But with a handful, maybe as little as two individuals carefully selected, and that's what happened to me, you could reconstruct Joseph Smith profile, Y chromosome profile, with an extreme degree of accuracy, as if you would get a sample directly from him.
Which you've done.
Which that's what I did. With living descendants, yeah. Okay? Not from Joseph Smith.
Right.
From,
no, I didn't mean that. Yeah,
we're
that's
not
a
talking
good point.
About exhumations or right, anything right. At this point.
But you can say with certainty
absolutely.
That you know what the Y chromosome of Joseph
yes,
Smith.
Yes, in fact, yeah. It wouldn't be only a unique signature to Joseph Smith, but it would be shared with descendants of Hiram Smith and Samuel Smith and brothers of Joseph Smith Sr. In fact, you know, as I was doing this for other purposes, you know, for genealogy, we came across individuals, Smith, surname Smith, males, that were descendants from all of this line, including descendants of Alexander Hale and Joseph III, who are the two sons of Joseph Smith that were successful in having a living posterity today. None of the other children that Joseph Smith had either grew up to adulthood or had a living posterity. So that was straightforward because at that point, once we reconstructed that for Joseph Smith, we did the same thing for Parley P. Pratt from other children, not Moroni's line, but others, and reconstructed a Pratt signature. We have the Smith signature, and then what we need to do was to find descendants of Moroni Pratt. And then we just lined them up, these profiles, and he was a perfect match to Parley and a complete mismatch to Joseph Smith.
Sure.
So not only we excluded Joseph as the father, but we confirmed Parley to be the father, the biological father for Moroni, born of Marianne Frost. And so we did that for a number of cases. In fact, a total of 7 cases of, and some are stronger than others, but each one of them have been somewhat documented somewhere. And each of the 7 cases involving male offspring were tested and resulted negative.
Right. And one of the places that it's documented for our listeners is in The Persistence of Polygamy, this book that I referenced earlier by John Whitmer Books.
Yeah, the book summarized, in the article, I summarized 5 of the 7 cases. The other 2 I work on after. And in fact, there is an article that I'm writing now that would include these 2. So that there is a place to have all of them. The original articles were in the Journal of Mormon History in 2005 and in the John Whitmer Historical Association Journal in 2007, where these 5 cases were detailed and described in that book. Is a summary of the event. Now, so why we could not use this with Josephine? Well, Josephine is a girl. Was a female, and so she did not inherit the Y chromosome from her father. And because of that, we cannot test any of her descendants for the Y chromosome. So the Y chromosome is not something we can use for her. Then there is the other thing, the other method is the mitochondrial DNA. It's a piece of DNA that goes from mother to all of her children, not just the girls, all of her children, but only the females pass it on to the next generation. And in this case also is not very helpful because Josephine would have had the mitochondrial DNA of her mother, Sylvia Session, and there is no reason to dispute that's
right.
Not the matter that we're trying to resolve.
Right,
you know,
right.
We think, you know, we're pretty safe there with that relationship. So the only one that is left is autosomal DNA testing. And the autosomes, we all have 23 pairs of chromosomes in our nucleus. And the first 22 pairs are called the autosomes, and the 23rd pair are the sex chromosomes, where the Y chromosome could be one of the variants there. That is the majority of our DNA. We're talking about over 3 billion pieces of information, okay? Extremely rich, extremely diverse, extremely informative. The problem is that it's not inherited in a straightforward manner like the Y chromosome and the mitochondrial DNA. So what happened is that a mother and a father, each having 100% of their autosomes, only gave 50% of it to each of their children. So immediately you lose 50% of the DNA. That's one limitation with autosomal DNA, is that you do not pass everything you have, like the Y chromosome, you pass the whole thing, or the mitochondrial DNA. No, you pass only half of it to your children. So immediately with Josephine's case, she would only have had 50% of her father, regardless if that father was Windsor or Joseph. And not only that, but then each successive generation, you continue to lose an additional 50% to the point in which is statistically 50% lost. But in reality, you can lose almost everything. Let me just give you an example. You know, I have 4 grandparents. You know, I can have as little as 0% and as much as 50% of each individual grandparent's DNA in me. So it's a probability. It's not a straightforward thing. And so we are not sure with Josephine, you know, how much of that DNA is still from her father is still available today. That's one problem. The other problem is there is reshuffling and the DNA mix up. There are segments. It's not shuffled as individual basis, but it's shuffled as segments. And so longer segments of DNA show closer relationship, and then eventually they become smaller, and eventually you can lose the whole segment at once, very quick. And so, yes, autosomal DNA is the only option that we have, but it's not an easy option. And that's why after, you know, 16 years now that I've been working on this family, just before I came here, I was looking at some stuff that I kept here in Nauvoo and in my basement. And I have letters from the family from 1999 and 2000 and pedigrees and swabs and hair that were given at the beginning, thinking, you know, maybe we can use one system or another, and just the technology wasn't there.
Yeah. So you've published your findings in several places, and you've mentioned some of those already. And one of the things that you lift up is that in trying to look if there's a connection between Smith and Lyon, it's problematic because they have common descendants and progenitors. Is that right? Can you speak to that a little bit?
One thing that didn't even cross my mind until we actually started looking more carefully at this situation was that when I was working at Sorenson, we were concerned with correlating genealogical data with genetic data. Our goal was to build a database where the two would communicate and help each other. And so we have very deep, accurate, extended genealogies, and therefore we had them also for the Josephine and the Smith family. Lateral lines, direct lines. We're talking about two families with pretty strong Mormon pioneer heritage, you know, and so the families have there is extended genealogical information about them that we can use, and that was if I open a parenthesis, one of the reasons why we start studying them is because there were great, and not only them but other families, they were great to calibrate our study at first. And of course, then you know, as people start raising questions, like, hey, we can do that because we have the data to do that.
So you've got large families with lots of genealogies already completed.
Yeah.
And so you can, it's literally unparalleled anywhere else in the world.
And anyone with a little bit of familiarity with genetics and hereditary diseases and so on, they know that most of the families that have been used to develop the knowledge that we have today about these things came from Utah. So it wasn't something typical or unique of us. We were trying to answer a question about relatedness, but University of Utah, the Human Genome Project, you know, everybody went to Utah. That's the place where you could find large families, multiple generations still alive because people tended to get married young and have children at a younger age. And then extended genealogical data available. So really... is the mecca for genetic studies there. And we were no different than anyone. So because we had the genealogies, what happened is that in the preliminary research that was published in 2010 in this book that we just mentioned, there was some genetics, some DNA that was shared between some of the samples that we were analyzing. And that provided an initial hint that perhaps there was a relationship between the Smith and the Josephine descendants. And then we saw that there was a score, the quantity of the DNA that these families, that this individual that we were comparing share. So the way that it works is that you take individual A from the Smith family and individual B from the Josephine family and you compare DNA. Then you take another individual from the Smith family and then compare maybe to the same individual of Josephine or to a different, you know, so you kind of doing this one-on-one comparison to see if they share any DNA in common. And we saw that some share more and some share less. And that's to be expected because it's random how much DNA survive to the modern generation. But when we look at the genealogies, we saw that the people that share the most DNA also share ancestry between the Smith and the Josephine family and the Fishers, the Lyons, that either predated or postdated the time frame of Josephine and Joseph Smith. And so there were people that were like, you know, okay, these two guys share a lot of DNA. Oh, maybe Joseph Smith is Joseph Finn's father. And then we find out they were like second cousin once removed, which means it's, a, you know, like we're talking about the last two generations, you know, and somebody got married between them. And so we realized, like, look, we're having two families now that have the opportunity here in the United States to meet randomly. They don't, they, you know, they fall in love, they get married, they have children and more DNA. So what we are seeing is that people are related at multiple levels, not just at the one level, at the one point that we were testing. And that was a big surprise and disappointment, because it really had a level of complexity that we were not expecting, that I wasn't expecting, which still today I don't know how, even with the more advanced and precise technology, how we can really bypass that.
Yeah.
And you cannot do this without knowing the genealogies, by the way. You can't.
Yeah, that was a question that I had looking at your results. That so is it possible to isolate that DNA from these people that either Joseph and Josephine both had in common, or later descendants that have shared ancestry? Is it possible to somehow isolate through doing a genealogical profile or DNA profile of those individuals?
Okay, so two considerations. One, we are dealing with statistics. So we will never, with the current approach and the current technology, no matter how better this technology will get, even if we sequence complete genomes, you know, right now we're doing a scanning, you know, about 500 to 700,000 bases, you know, out of the 3.2 billion that we have. It doesn't matter how this will improve. We will never be able to come to a 100% answer. It's not a black and white yes and no answer, okay? Anyone that that deals with paternity testing knows that you can exclude a father 100%, but you cannot include it 100% in the relationship. It will always be a 99% or something. And that's with the direct testing of father to child, having the actual two people. Here we're talking about individuals that lived five, six, seven generations in the past. And so we're dealing with fragments of DNA, not the whole genome of these people. So that's one consideration to know, that we're dealing with statistics. The other things that we are trying, that that I am trying to do, is this one. That I am going to use the technology we have now to reconstruct the best possible autosomal profile that we can do for Joseph Smith, and then the same thing for Josephine. And when I have these two profiles reconstructed, then I will compare them one with another. So rather than comparing one individual with another individual, one from the Smith and one from the Josephine, I will focus first in comparing all the Joseph Smith descendants among each other, and then all the Josephine descendants, and then see how much of their progenitor, these two progenitors' DNA have survived down to these people. So if I can then reconstruct a 20% profile or a 30% profile, I will use that to see if there is any affinity. And at that point, we'll have to run some algorithm and trying to see, you know, what is the chance that these two people or these two profiles are related versus any two random individual in the population, you know.
And can you speak to differences or things you're able to do today in research that you weren't able to do back in, whether it was 1999 or 2005, that would allow you to do this that wouldn't even be a possibility back then?
So in 1999, when the family, the descendants are approaching us with, you know, can we use DNA to answer this question? We knew we didn't have the technology to do that. We knew those were the first year where barely we could do things with a Y chromosome, you know, and we haven't even thought about it. In fact, we weren't even yet approached with the other cases involving males. You know, at that point, you know, Josephine was the first case presented. And asking, you know, can you use DNA? Definitely there was It was a question on the mind of Josephine descendants that was there for a long time, you know, and as soon as they heard of DNA, it's like, maybe this could be the answer. And there was no answer back in 1999. The technology wasn't there. But what we had was the capability to collect, extract, and preserve DNA. And the urgency was that some of Josephine's grandchildren that would have had 25% of her autosomal DNA were still alive. They were in the late 80s, early 90s. We knew they were not going to be around forever. You know, sad but true. That's the reality. You don't wish anyone to die, but you kind of have to deal with that. And so what we, I mean, these would be people that they met Josephine, you know, in their when they were children. And so had their DNA in them. And so we decided to start collecting these samples. And we didn't even know how to do it in the most effective way, because we didn't know when the technology was going to be around. And so you needed to preserve that. So one of the things we did was collecting swabs that I still have, never extracted, and I'm considering. In fact, I'm negotiating with a company to see if we can extract some DNA from these swabs. These are swabs that have been collected 16 years ago, okay, and I still have them, and that was one. And then we started doing mouthwash because it would yield 50 times more DNA than swabs, and we had the capabilities of Sorensen to extract that DNA, and once the DNA is extracted, it's more stable over time. But there was not yet the technology to do that. So the goal originally was, let's get this DNA now that we have it, and let's see what's happening. Now, one of the things we were doing at Sorensen was also to develop the techniques. We weren't just waiting for a lab to come out with the techniques and then we would borrow that. So there was, at that time, a lot of in-house experimentation and testing and developing. And in 2003, we presented a scientific poster to the American Society of Human Genetics conference that had an extended pedigree in it. It wasn't labeled as the Fisher or the Lyon, Josephine Lyon pedigree, but that's what it was. And he had 120 descendants from the 9 children of Josephine, 9 children. So 120, they were representing these 9 children. So very beautifully built and represented and diverse tree. And what we did was to look at markers called STRs, which is one of the two ways that you can read DNA. You can do that with STRs, which are microsatellites, which are little chunks of DNA, or little sequences of DNA, or with SNPs, where you look at actual individual bases, which is what many companies do today. You know, it seems that is the most effective way to do that. Back in 2000, 2002, 2003, we didn't know that. No one knew that. Okay, it was all in an experimental phase. So in 2003, we published this poster and we successfully reconstructed a number of STRs assigned to Josephine and her husband, John, that we would find in the living descendants. But that was nothing that could answer the question. I mean, that's where, you know, as far as we could have gone at that time. And then in 2008, 2009, there was some of this SNP testing becoming available. And University of Utah, with which we had several collaborations in place, acquired some of the technology to test these SNPs. Again, these were all in-house testing, which means that any sample run through these procedures could only be compared and validated within that company or that university. So if I would have to publish their results or compare those results to maybe something produced by another university, they would have not been calibrated sufficiently to compare apples with apples. Okay, but you could start doing some sort of preliminary investigation, which resulted then in a handful of samples from Smith and Josephine that were included in this pilot testing, and whose results then became part of the article that is found in the Persistence of Polygamy. And that was also the time that Mr. Sorensen died. And funding stopped, and the company was basically what we're going to do with it. That was the family, Sorensen family, wanted to do. And that was a time for everybody to kind of find a job
right.
as well. So a lot of priorities came in our mind. And instead, but true, everything, a lot of projects I have, this is one project. I have dozens of projects I was working on. Some I was able to wrap up and publish and get it done. You know, there are some in science, some with genealogy, others that were just halfway through, like this Josephine case. And for a couple of years, there was just nothing happened. Eventually, the whole data set was sold to Ancestry.com. Some of my colleagues went to work to Ancestry. The verbal agreement was that we were going to be, you know, it was like a new house for the project, for the samples, but that we were going to be able to continue and finish and working on these things. And that never happened. You know, there's been a different communication exchange with Ancestry, but the legal agreements under the new ownership did not include using these samples, which now became part of a large data set. We're not just part of one study. To them, we're just like any samples to be used for specific case studies. I'm still negotiating with them, particularly for the samples that belong to individuals in the Josephine and the Smith family that have passed on since we started the project in 1999. And I've been told that I can access those because we need to see if there is still any DNA left, because DNA will still degrade over time. And so that's another possibility that we can access those. In the meantime, the family agreed to, in the last couple of years, to do some retesting. And so we are using 23andMe, who is a commercial company who tests the SNP testing, about 500,000 to 700,000 of them. And so we start collecting and retesting them both on the Smith family and on the Josephine side.
So recently there has been some challenges to your research. There's been mention of the fact that these samples are with Ancestry.com and that you have not published any findings related to it. I don't want to say conspiracy theory, but there's been online some mention, some questioning of why hasn't anything conclusive been put out there?
One of the criticism that heard recently is what a waste, you know, of time, resources, sample, you know, and not have anything out. Those are general statements that, you know, that are understandable, you know, from an outsider point of view, when there is not the institutionalized knowledge that people that work directly on these issues are available. So I understand, but I'm not upset that somebody would think that, because I would probably have the same thoughts, you know, if I had to look at something from the outside. Let me say a couple of things about that. So first, cost. You know, I did mention in one of my presentations in 2009 that an estimated, and that was a rough estimate that I made, based on what it would cost back then to collect, extract, preserve, and test some of the samples, that I say, you know, probably $100,000 were spent on it, which is still today is a considerable amount of money for a family project. Now, that's not cash money that actually was given, and that I saw, that I had, that was spent. We have to consider the fact that, you know, Sorensen had a laboratory and a whole organization in place that was working. And so I could put in things as pleased as I was working to some projects. So I had accessibility to resources and labs that I do not have today. And if I would have had to pay back then to have those things done, would have cost me that much money. No one was putting that money in. I don't know if that's we were using the resources that already existed. The second point is the cost of technology. I mean, in 2002, the U.S. government produced the first human genome project. The first human genome was completely sequenced, and the estimated cost was $1 billion to do that. That was in 2002. Today, we can do that for an individual for less than $1,000. Okay, so we have to be careful when we say, you know, I spent $100,000 10 years ago, because today would have not cost that much money to do that. But if you wanted to start something, that was what you have to pay back in those days. So you can't make the same comparison. The other thing is, like, you know, why is never anything came out? I already explained to you that first we had the samples, but we didn't have the technology. And then we ran into these roadblocks, you know, with the death of Mr. Sorensen, the lab that didn't no longer existed, the resources that were no longer available, the technology that we were going to trying to develop that never got developed, and then the passing of samples to Ancestry with a verbal agreement that we could use them, and then in reality we could not. Then there was a change of job for me, relocated to another country. And in the meantime, starting to you know, juggle all these things at the same time. I'm not looking for excuses or understanding, but that's what really happened. I am grateful that the families, both the Smith family and the Josephine family, never gave up, and we all been working. But sometimes you're working at a certain speed, and other time you kind of have to put things on the back burner, and other times you just get to it whenever you can. And so, you know, it happens with people that write articles and do research in any kind, and so on. I have projects on population genetics I was able to get out and publish, and there are others that are just sitting there and kind of trying to figure out what's the best way to move them forward. So we have some technology today that is very promising, and we are also the critical fork, because this is a question we say that has been going on for 150 years, and we lose half of the DNA at every generation, which means that if we had the technology 150 years ago, we could have answered this question overnight. But we couldn't. In fact, only in the last couple of years, in the last, you know, handful of years, maybe like 5 or 6 years, we have technology that is sufficiently good to address this question. But what we are dealing now is that the people that carry the right DNA are disappearing. They're dying. And so the new generation would always have less and less or none at all of that DNA. And if you wait another 1 or 2 or 3 generation, you probably won't have any of that DNA in living individuals. And so we're kind of having at that balance. Either we're going to give her the best shot now, or we're not going to be able to do that at any point. And so will we be able to answer this question? I don't know. I don't know if we can give a sufficiently good answer that people will accept it as conclusive. I think what happened in 2010, when I published the first preliminary results, we dealt with a check reality check that show us some of the limitations that we didn't think. I think those limitations are still very much valid today. You can't just take 10 people that are descendants of Josephine and say, here is your answer. Or 10 people that are descendants of Joseph Smith, this is your answer. Just today, I was looking at some of Josephine descendants and their DNA. Not even a comparison with the Smith. Just some descendants. And none of the people I was looking at had any overlapping DNA, which means that based on what I was looking today, I could not even reconstruct Josephine DNA. Okay, this was just a very small handful of individuals. This will change as more individuals will be tested and are tested, but we're not going to get a complete profile for her.
Sure.
And we're not going to get it for Joseph Smith.
And people are going to draw conclusions based on your conclusion. And at the end of the day, what you're presenting are percentages, statistics. Yeah. The only, you know, as you mentioned the other night, the only way that we would know for sure is to exhume both bodies of Josephine and Joseph and do a test that way.
Which the family, actually the Josephine family, is in favor of doing, and they have been proposing to do that for a number of years. I have been involved with exhumations in the past for identification testing, and the legalities, the bureaucracy, the timing, the cost, and not only that, the testing, because right now we can get some saliva from a person and commercially test it for $100, you know. When you deal with ancient remains, because anything that is dead for like a month is considered ancient, you know, there is degradation, contamination, and there are very the number of labs that can provide that testing are very few, and as far as I know, they're all connected with universities, and they usually would not test that for you unless you have some sort of relationship with them. They do not provide that kind of testing to the public, or you can go through forensic, some forensic labs, and I think I am pretty confident if I have to cross the bridge that I can do it because of the connections that I developed over my years of research in these areas. But I'm also willing to first try this one last approach, and if this doesn't work, then that will be the next and ultimate step.
Would it be possible to exhume Josephine and then just work with Smith descendants that you have? Because, I mean, obviously there's huge barriers with even talking about Joseph Smith's body. I mean, I'm not even sure that would be a possibility.
I don't exclude it, though.
Sure.
I'm an optimistic person. You know, things can change and happen, and you can never say no, you know. But it will be sufficient, I think, at that point to exhume Windsor Lion and do the test between the two. It will be a paternity test. If you find a good lab that can produce that type of result, you probably at that point will not need to bother with Joseph Smith. Or you could test maybe... If it comes to maybe a close relative of Joseph Smith at that point, you know, maybe Samuel or another one of his brothers that might not be so delicate, you know, the situation.
Sure.
Too.
Sure.
But I think at that point you could do Windsor and Josephine and even the mother, you know, Sylvia Session, and you do the... like what you would do for a regular paternity testing, but you're dealing with incomplete genomes. The degradation of the DNA after 150 years is quite considerable. So you'll have to do you have to amplify the DNA first, and then you have to control the environment in which all the testing and the collection is done, and then you know, see if you can regenerate those markers that will provide that sort of relationship. So it is doable, and it will be more a straightforward approach at that point. You know, you might not get 100%, but it will be like 98%, 99%, and you know at that point that for legal purposes is as good as it gets.
Right.
You know, but here right now with the approach we're having right now, it's a big unknown still.
Right. Yeah. So in a... above all of the science and every in this search that you've been undertaking for the last 16 years, there are questions of religious meaning, religious value. I think of Parley P. Pratt saying that his children were Joseph Smith's ultimately in the next life, even knowing, you know, what we know now, that Moroni was indeed Parley's son, and yet the religious meaning and value that he assigned in that situation was different than what the biological meaning or the genetic meaning was after. And so people are going to draw their conclusions no matter what happens. And I think, you know, we've been having a conversation without referencing the other side, but one of the reasons, in addition to grandchildren dying and the loss of autosomal DNA, there is a real urgency or a renewed interest that's been placed in this by some of the critiques that have been made by the Mormon Genome Project about your work. And so I have this question. I'm curious, How much room for interpretation is there in studying DNA? Or to put it another way, can a geneticist's biases fundamentally flaw their methods and how they present their findings? And I think in this instance, either side might call the other biased because of their faith or their lack thereof, that there's some sort of agenda outside of science that will distort the findings.
I agree with your statement. Actually, you don't need to have religion involved. As a scientist and the other publications that I've been involved with, it's always hard to find consensus. And even when you publish a paper, it is expected that somebody else will publish in the same journal a response to your paper, where they would stress some of the limitation or things that what we call alternative hypothesis, you know. At the end, it depends on the person how much weight they want to put on the results, how much they want to see into that. A good scientist will have the data and then draw a conclusion from the data. A poor scientist will already kind of have a conclusion in his mind or in her mind, and then trying to feed the data to that conclusion. For anyone that studies statistics, even at a general level, you know that there are different statistical tests that you can apply to the data, and not all of them will give you the same results. And so I have seen that, sad but true, you know, in scientists that had the data and ran a test, and the test didn't say much, the statistical test didn't give a good value, significance to the results, and then discarded and just run another one, and then the results was a little stronger and decided to use that in their publication. And good journals, peer-reviewed journals in science are aware of this, and so before something is published, these papers are given to peer reviewers, and they, a good peer reviewer will question. It's like, why didn't you use this other statistical test, or why did you choose this one, or, you know? And so in that case, then the editor goes back to you and say, okay, these are the critics to your results, you know, can you adjust that? And if you cannot adjust it, then they will not publish that. That means it's not good stuff. So now, going back to this case, you know, okay, we have the Human Genome Project and whatever agenda they might have to run this project, and then there is me being working.
You mean the Mormon Genome Project?
See, what did I call it?
You said Human Genome Project.
Oh, sorry, the Mormon Genome Project. The Mormon Genome Project and whatever agenda they might have to test this, this project or come out with results here, and there is me. You know, and I've been criticized because, you know, I'm a believer in Latter-day Saints, and so they say, you know, well, you are doing this to defend something or to hide something or to protect the church. And for people that have looked at my work closely, they can honestly tell you that that is not the case. I think I have a pretty good track record of being pretty objective with my observation. The type of journals I've been published in are not tabloids, you know, we're talking about high impact factor in the scientific community with very rigid scrutiny and peer review processes. To start with, I have absolutely no problem. In fact, I believe Josephine could be Joseph's daughter, and I know Joseph Smith practiced polygamy. And I don't think it was all celestial or spiritual. I mean, you know, I think that some of the relationship he had were full marriage relationship. Otherwise, I could not explain why Brigham Young was doing what he was doing if he didn't learn it from Joseph Smith. I would have a bigger problem there, you know, in the inconsistency or discrepancy between Nauvoo polygamy and Utah polygamy. So I am more comfortable, if we can say that, about polygamy, with a continuation on the way that it was done. And so if Brigham Young was doing it a certain way, then probably Joseph was doing it a certain way. So again, I have no problem to take the affidavit by Josephine to be literal and biological. I don't know enough about the history, polyandry, sexuality that could have taken place. I'm going to leave that to the historians to deal with it. And my goal here is to see if science can show a connection between these two individuals. And I will continue to try and work on it as long as there are going to be resources and support from the families to do that. In the last 15, 16 years, I was able to work with both families extensively. I think there is a relationship of trust. I think this is a family matter. There are people here that are really concerned with their family history and knowing the truth. And I'm going to use whatever thing I have to my avail to assist them with that. What they're going to do with this information, or what others are going to do with this information, is not for me to say. And I will be stepping in areas that are not mine at that point. I can tell you that with all the assurance that I can bring, that if I cannot answer this question, I doubt anybody else will. And I'm not challenging anybody here, but when everything is going to be done and said, you got to have out the methodologies, how you reach those conclusions, why you think what you're thinking based on the data you have, and other people need to look at that data and being able to contradict or support your conclusion. It is the data, not the conclusions, that needs to speak. Okay, so as long as you have data and people can look at that data and reason with you why you're saying that, then everybody's going to be agree at that point, regardless of their religion, affiliation, or their belief. And if I didn't publish anything, it's because there was nothing to publish. And whatever thing there was to be published was published. In 2009, I said that by the end of the year, I was going to have something out, and I did. But it wasn't exciting. And I was hoping it was going to be exciting, but it wasn't. And so I didn't make a big fuss about it. And some people thought that that was hiding something. But it was there, you know, and could be read, it could be found, could be Googled and researched and read and questions, specific questions asked about why I reached those conclusions. And the data was there. I published tables with the data on it.
Well, and you, since 2009, and because of this renewed interest, And a sense, I would think, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a sense that you have of ownership on wanting to see this project through, you have revived or renewed your efforts recently and have started collecting funding as well. Did you want to talk about that at all and where you're at?
Sure. So back last fall was about when... the family, consider now I've been gone for a couple of years, learning a new job, getting settled in a new place. I do not have the resources I used to have. I don't have the samples. What I have are folders and files. I have everything that I collected from 2000. I told you I still have the swabs that were collected back then, which I'm considering using them. You know, I totally forgot I had them until, because file them, you know. We say no, let's use another method of collection. But just recently I found all these swabs that I have from these people, which I can try, you know, to give a, but I don't have access to a lab like I used to. So now I'm an independent researcher, and so last fall the family say, what can we do? Is there anything we can do to move forward? And I was a little bit reluctant because I felt like somehow things that were out of our control, both the family and myself, came in. And to start all over again was not going to be very exciting. Although we have all the genealogies and we knew what happened and what was done and the limitations, to go after again. And so the family say, well, you know, we're going to talk with the family and see what we decide, you know, what we're going to decide to do. And so they decide to move forward. You know, we're talking about asking the same people for a sample for like the third time. You know,
right.
That could be, it's like, what are you doing with my stuff? Yeah. You know, what are you doing with that? Do you know what you're doing? You know, and they saw what happened. They are with me with what happened. So maybe I don't feel like I have ownership, but I feel like I'm part of the family. we kind of share the same pain in what have happened in the years. So they say, you know, we are going to provide the funding for the testing. We are going to provide the legwork, and what we need is for you to direct the project like you've been doing it. So they understand and they see that I can do this, even with all that has happened. And so starting last fall, we came out with a plan, and we decided to use 23andMe, and the families began again collecting samples. In fact, some of them have been already collected slowly, but it wasn't a huge priority to me. And then the question was, how am I going to get the samples from the Smith, because they are not interested in paying for it. And so about 2 months ago in June, somebody suggested to me to use GoFundMe, which is a website where you can put a set amount of money as a goal, and then individual can donate to your project. And so I started this project called GoFundMe.com/JosephSmithDNA, and people have been extremely responsive and generous. In 30 days, I raised over $7,000, and each DNA kit cost about $100, and the money that I raise is going to be used only for Smith samples. And all the Smith family has been extremely supportive and responsive. They say, okay, I got the money, we're going to give you the samples. They're coming in faster than I can actually keep track. I spent all day today just organizing that work, and it's a huge effort. I can do that, you know, now that I'm on vacation, I can spend more time on it, but during a regular week or regular time, it's a part-time experience. So we have the funding, we have the samples, they're coming in, the results are coming in already, and hopefully by the end of the year we'll have enough samples and analysis in place to say, okay, this is the best we can do, and what does this say. And I think this is, you know, this is the best shot we can give it. That's, I told the family, you know, this is going to be our best shot at it.
Well, and I'm really excited. So the end of 2015 is a guess, but I'm very excited to see what findings you're able to come out with.
Yeah. And it will take some time before you actually get everything on paper and published. Sure. I mean, I wrote the article in 2009, it got out in 2010, and then they got a round table in it. So in 2011, they got a new one with the right table. So, you know, you can never predict, you know, that. You can use, you know, online resources to publish this stuff too. But.
Right. Well, I really appreciate your time. I appreciate having a chance to sit down and talk with you, and for you to share your research. And I really find all of this incredibly fascinating from a cultural standpoint, historical, and scientific. Mm-hmm. And I know I mentioned this last night, and I realize some of the things that have been said about your research may not have been the way you would have worded it, so that I could imagine that there's some frustration that could be there. But for me, I mean, this is just a fascinating thing to see, this renewed interest. And I mentioned last night that it seems like to me that it's the closest thing we have to a Mormon space race. And, as long as methodologies are sound, the findings are sound and able to be peer-reviewed, I'm curious to see what both sides present, but I wish you the very best, and I'm looking forward to what research you're able to provide.
Well, thank you, and I do welcome others working on the project as long as they're going to have the right methodology in place, because it's going to be helpful to me to use as a control. You know, and a validation and compare it. And the conclusions will be arbitrary at that point. If you don't consider the genealogies and the mixed relationships, and you don't carefully choose the people that you're testing, but you just randomly test whoever claim a descendancy, then you're going to have some data that will say something but might not be what you're reading through it. So there are other factors besides collecting a DNA samples here. It's not like ordering pizza here.
Sure.
You can have to look very, and if you're not willing to analyze the limitation and talk about them in your in any research that you're doing, then you're leaving out a big chunk and you're lying to the people that will read it, because you're taking advantage of the fact that a lot of people do not have the experience that you have and the understanding that you have in science, and so they will think that what you're saying is how things are. So you have a responsibility, you're accountable to tell them exactly how you did it and exactly what you could not do and why.
Is there a professional organization that certifies geneticists?
There isn't. Your certification is what we call is more like your credentials, and that comes from the work that you have done.
Sure.
And who you have done it with and where you publish it. We have different values that we use in science. One of those I told you was it's called an impact factor, IF, which is a value given to a journal, and the more credible and sound the science that is published, the higher is this impact factor, but it's also harder to get things published in those journals because the scrutiny and how strict they are with their parameters that they enforce. And then there are some journals that have extremely low quality where you can have 10 papers published there and they will not be as good as one paper published in a high impact factor.
Sure.
Then we have things like the H index for scientists, how many times their work is cited by other scientists. And so all these things are kind of a way for somebody to say, hey, that person, knows what he's doing. And I don't think I am the best that is out there, but I do work a lot with people that know a lot more than I do, and I trust their judgment and their expertise, and I learn from them, and I'm willing, and I have to be accept criticism, accept feedback in order to do what I'm doing better. And it's a hard thing, it takes a lot of work. You don't become scientist in the morning just because you want to be one. There is a price to pay, and there's a lot of work, and get people to accept that. Not just any people, but like your peers that understand how science works, and they need to accept that.
So if the Mormon Genome Project were to hire a credentialed professional geneticist, somebody that whose work could be the methodology and the work and the results, that you could peer review, others could peer review. As a scientist, it may be difficult to look at the work of another group doing the same thing, but it seems like to me that as a scientist that as long as it's professionally done, that you could look at that and the value that's in it.
There is one thing that a geneticist will not be able to do. It is to understand everything in the historical and genealogical context. You cannot give them 20 genetic profiles and ask a person, are these genetic profiles related, or is there an indication that this person back 150 years ago fathered this girl, and leave it like that. The geneticist will need to access things like the genealogical data and being able to measure if there was other factors that are showing the data to be what they are. Are we going to see the DNA, which is what I saw and published in 2010, I show affinity, association, relationship, share DNA between individual descendant of Josephine and descendant of Smith. But I would have never thought to look at the genealogy until somebody brought that to my attention. And because we had the genealogy, I saw, I saw correlation. The closer the individuals were related genealogically, the more DNA they share. And so that became a relationship that if I would have pulled out the Josephine Joseph Smith equation, you know, there was a linear association between the level of relationship they share in other ways other than Josephine and Joseph Smith and the amount of DNA that they share. So Joseph Smith and Josephine were not playing a role in the results I was seeing. Something else was playing a role. And that was what I call background noise that does not allow me to clearly discern that. So the question, if I would just give that DNA to somebody without the genealogy, is like, do you think these two families are related? Somebody would have said probably, yes, they are. And then take it and leave it like that and go around and use that, spread it, and come out with all sorts of conclusion about it, you know? You know, I cannot say that with the data that we have because of these genealogies that we had. So, the question goes back, would a geneticist, professional geneticist, you know, is he going to be paid to say something? Or is he going to be paid to provide an objective evaluation and asking the right question? Sometimes, you know, I don't know what happened behind the scene, but sometimes we kind of tend to feed people the wrong scenario and then expecting them to provide us an answer which we take to support our case. But the bias of what we have fed this person is what caused them to say what they said. I don't know if that makes any sense. So would anybody with the Mormon Genome Project being able to provide all the details in an objective context where a geneticist will be able to provide an answer? That is going to be fundamental, and we'll be able to know and have access to that conversation.
And what that raises for me is the issues over whether science should be used as a battering ram to either prove or disprove religion. And I think that misses the point to both science and religion.
Absolutely.
And so our meaning and value that we derive from religion, whether we're talking about the Book of Mormon and Native American DNA, or we're talking about Josephine Lyon, the value that we derive from religion and its meaning is on a completely different plane than the kind of scientific meaning that I would hope the scientific community is after. And, you know, I can't speak to biases on the part either, you know, either the Mormon Genome Project or your research. I mean, I think we all know that we all have agendas. We all have a place that we stand. Mm-hmm. And we all have our biases.
Absolutely.
Now, the question is, do they get in the way, or when we form our methodology, do we allow them to be something that we're trying to prove rather than letting the data to speak for itself?
Well, here is the answer to that question. Is the question we're trying to test Josephine paternity, regardless of the Joseph Smith, Mormonism, polygamy, sexual polyandry, you know, can we remove all of that and just focus on the paternity of Joseph Smith? Who was of Josephine? Who was Josephine's father? Can we provide a study that will answer that question and data that will support an answer to that question? Or are we concerned in trying to find something that will support or enlighten us or condemn things like polygamy and sexual polyandry? And because in my mind, these are two completely different issues. You cannot use science to test people's ethics, morals, and motivations. You cannot do that. You know, whatever Joseph Smith did 150 years ago is not going to come from DNA testing the paternity. Can we separate the two? And that is going to be the key. You know, we are trying to answer one question. That's what the Josephine study is. We're trying to answer the question about her paternity. And once we produce data, we'll need to be able to show people how we came to that conclusion, if she is or she's not, that the daughter of Joseph Smith. and that should end there. That people will take this information and try to fit it into an historical context, promote their agenda, their biases, whatever that is, but it should be done afterward independently to answer this question. And again, this is a family study. I have to educate individuals in the Joseph Smith family, in the Josephine family. They are concerned about things like that, like sexual polyandry. They are concerned with the biases of historians and the accuracy of the historical record. And I told them, it's like, you got to be keeping these two separated. If you want to learn about more about the history and the motivation and the ethical reasoning behind that, then you have to go elsewhere and find other sources. With DNA, we're going to answer one question if we can, and one question only in this paternity. And that is what we are, the hypothesis that we need to test. That anybody that will want to be involved with this project has to focus on that.
Well, and obviously this is a conversation that doesn't end here. Even after the paternity results, you know, and even then, it's going to be just a statistic.
Yeah.
But once we have some more conclusive results, it's a conversation that's going to continue far beyond this. And so I thank you for your time. I thank you for sitting down and talking about your research. And again, I wish you the very best as you move forward.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by the Latter-day Seekers team from Community of Christ. The views expressed in this podcast are the opinions of those speaking and do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or official stance of Community of Christ or the Latter-day Seekers team.